All right, welcome everyone to episode number 14. I think we're on this one. Talking tonight with Jason Stangroom, who is currently on the line. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I am fantastic, as always, because it's late at night and the kids are asleep, and that means I can do this sort of thing, which is good.
Excellent.
And you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes.
Just went out, had dinner, come back.
Yep, good time to just sit back and have a chat.
All right. Now, Jason, do you want to give yourself a bit of an introduction, just so the listeners know who you are in case they're not aware of your awesomeness?
Okay. I'm not sure about awesomeness, but as you've said, my name is Jason. I currently work for Redify. I have been doing that for past year and a half. I specialize predominantly in build mastering, release engineering, TFS and PowerShell related goodness.
So being a build master release engineer for a job, that's a bit unusual for most people. I don't know that many organizations have that role per se.
No, definitely not. And I started out as your typical developer, but I've also worked in a lot of small organizations where you end up doing a lot of the sysadmin infrastructure work as well. And it's when you start to combine these two skill sets that you find a set of skills that's quite fitting to somebody who does look after builds and deployments and all that sort of jazz. And so naturally, when you get to a team where sort of enough size that these things start to become quite a significant requirement, I naturally tend to drift to that role. And it's now sort of reached the point where I'm regularly finding myself as being dedicated in that role.
So do you find there's a particular team size or a complexity of project where the sweet spot is?
It's probably about the same size as the sweet spot for a scrum team of, what, 6 or 7, is it?
7 plus or minus 2.
Yeah. I think it's probably around there. But at the same time, while I do end up being the guy who does that sort of work, I think it's important to sort of try and spread those skills around the team as much as possible so you don't end up dependent on one person.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of value, I think, in the team at least being aware of a lot of the concerns of the release and build role. So decisions that they can make in their designs up front can really pay off when it does come to releasing into production.
For example?
So many issues aren't found until you do get further down the environment pipeline. Things like just thinking about permissions. It's all too typical for developers to all be running with full administrator privileges on their machines, and it's very easy to get quite far through the development cycle before you realize that the service accounts that are going to be running in production don't have access to the sort of things you've been assuming they'll have access to. And inevitably, you tend to see that mean to production service accounts suddenly get way too many rights, because that's the easy fix. But it's definitely not the right way to be doing things. And when people do find backdoors in the software, if they've got far too many privileges, that's when things really get nasty.
Do you find that teams have trouble understanding the role of a build master, and that the role, though it's important and people go, yeah, I need a build master, at times they really don't know what that build master should be doing, because they think, yeah, you set up cruise control or TFS and I put on continuous integration and I get my code compiling and I just run some unit tests out of an assembly and then I'm done. So what do I need a build master for?
Well, yeah, that's obviously the beginnings of the role. But typically, a project is growing over time. You know, you're adding new features, etc. And so there are components to sort of continue to evolve the build process as well. Additionally, there's value in the build master then being able to gather up a lot of the data that's coming out of these builds and feed that back to the team.
Such as test coverage, I assume, as an obvious one?
Yeah, test coverage is the basic one. There's other metrics. You start getting into cyclomatic complexity and all your various sort of depths of of function calls, all those sort of fancy metrics that can be good to feed back. FX cop violations, indeed. But it also tends to come into the deployment side of things as well. The continuous integration build is great for getting quick feedback when somebody checks in something that breaks that's, I guess, statically verifiable. But there's a lot of stuff that you need to deploy to some kind of integration environment with a set of test data and get all the feedback there from, you know, runtime integration and functional tests as well. And there can be some maintenance in keeping those systems right and being able to set up new ones and keep the data, test data fresh, etc.
So you're talking about resetting build environments and taking production database snapshots and dropping it into a server, etc.
Yeah, yeah, and a lot of this stuff, ultimately, you do want to automate everything if you can. But yeah, it's something that you discover throughout a project. There's always new requirements at that part of the process as well.
Just coming back to the metrics, that's one of the things I personally get a bit of a kick out because I'm a stats dude at times.
Yep.
And I like my coverage and I like trying to keep track of technical debt with numbers to actually prove that we're staying on top of our technical debt. And as our code base grows, you know, our debt level stays low. You know, there's nothing worse than getting your code increasing and the amount of crap that's in the code just getting faster and bigger than the actual code itself. But do you find that you have issues at times trying to convey that back to the teams? And so, you know, you're picking up these stats and you look at it over a number of builds and a number of iterations, and you see that say, the FX cop violations, you know, they were sitting around 50, now they're sitting up around 100, and now they're up at 120, 140, and it just keeps getting bigger. And people go, yeah, you know, we need to do something about that. But it's just FX cop, it doesn't matter. Do you have that attitude to deal with?
Certainly. And I guess a lot of it is because compared to delivering new features or fixing bugs, they're a lot less tangible in the short term to address those metrics. I think we've all sort of come to appreciate that increased technical debt, complexity, lack of coverage can really contribute over time to reduce quality of code and software if you don't get on top of that. But sort of trying to make that a more urgent need to address is definitely something that gets tackled at the build master role.
So do you tie the build into or that information into a done criteria for your teams? You know, that done definition or what releasable software means?
Definitely. There's quite a few things that I like to tack on to a done criteria. Obviously, making sure that builds pass is definitely is one of them, and sadly it's all too often. Oh yeah, and sadly all too often isn't necessarily part of the standard or typical done criteria.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
It is. And then you got the making sure your test coverage is up there. Trying to find a good percentage for test coverage is always a hotly debated topic. But whatever you come to agree on the team, often it can be as simple as more than what we did last time. I also like to add in requirements around deploying stuff as well. Typically, you find out that you've got several environments to process through before something goes from dev to production. And in the I think it's the Scrum process. One of the concepts is at the end of each iteration, you should have something that is shippable.
Yep.
And I like to take that as far as it's shippable to the point of it has an installer that works. And so I like to make that as part of the done criteria whenever I can. It's usually takes a few failed deployments to convince the team that that's a good thing.
Failed production deployments you're talking about.
Well, not necessarily production deployments, but it can even be just getting to having a late delivery of an iteration because, you know, someone spent 2 days trying to get an environment in the middle working because it's not like dev.
So the UAT environment, for instance.
Or exactly, yeah. Or whatever name you happen to give to that, those environments that live between dev and the final production, yeah.
On that, the deployment cycle, you're doing that as part of the continuous build?
No. More recently, I've been doing it as part of a nightly, especially now with Team Foundation Server 2010 having the lab management component. It's very easy to have a build deploy a set of VMs and then push the build output into that for running tests in a well-known environment. And so with that feature now available, I've been aiming to have nightly builds that'll do that process.
Not everyone will have 2010 or be aware of what's involved in that. How does that actually work? So you've got, what, an MS build script that runs and then some custom tasks?
It's quite integrated. There's not too much customization required to get the basics out of it. Basically, you would have a Hyper-V infrastructure. I believe VMware support is in the pipeline. You would then have Microsoft System Center Virtual Machine Manager over the top of that, and TFS communicates through Virtual Machine Manager, and you get a nice GUI, the Microsoft Test Manager, which allows you to also configure the labs for each of your projects. You can define a set of machines, put them in a single environment, label the machines as the, you know, this machine is the database server, this machine is the web server, this is the domain controller. You can snapshot them together as,
as an environment. So you set them up as a completely separate domain?
This is an option. Yep. There's several different ways. For environments that do projects that have dependencies on the way a domain is set up, I will put a domain controller in an environment.
Okay.
Websites that are much simpler, I might just have a web server, a single machine in an environment. And once you've defined your environment in the test manager, you can then go into your standard Visual Studio build definitions, create a new build, and when you get to the process stage where you would typically choose the default template, you would pick the solutions you wanted to build, what configuration, what build agent you wanted to run on. You get the alternative now of choosing a lab build template. And when you choose that, you're given a different set of options. Basically, you get to choose, firstly, which build the lab should be using to deploy. So I would typically choose a continuous integration build.
Yep.
And you can decide whether you want to use the most recent one or have it trigger another one just for deploying into the lab.
Yep.
You then also choose the environment. So this then allows you to pick the environment you've defined in the test manager and optionally pick a snapshot in that environment you want it restored to at the beginning of every lab run.
So you can actually restore the entire environment, which that's effectively rebuilding the OS, or it's a snapshot of the Hyper-V machines at one point in time?
In this case, it's a snapshot of the Hyper-V machines at one point in time. The way Lab Manager can be configured is to take VM templates stored in the Virtual Machine Manager library, and it will do a sysprep on those and spin them up and give them new names and IP addresses. And so you can, it's not building them up from a blank machine and doing an OS install. You still have to do that part yourself at the moment. But yeah, you can get quite tricky with what you have available.
So it's a bit like a what's the network install from an image, something like that?
Yeah, like a remote network install.
Yeah, can't remember the name off the top of my head. Doesn't matter. The Pix boot.
That's the one, Pixie. Yep. Yeah, so you can do that sort of stuff. Typically, I've been setting up machines, especially because you get the fun of deploying SQL Server just right with all the appropriate settings and some other third-party components that require some configuration. And so I find it easy to build the VMs up and then create a snapshot in that state.
So the System Center is not something most people have, though, so doesn't that make it a little bit
tough? I do believe that people licensed to use Team Foundation Server with the Lab Manager do get a restricted license to use System Center to handle that, much as you also get the, the SQL license to use with TFS.
Yep.
But I'm not a licensing...
For the lab environment.
Exactly. But at the same time, I'm not a licensing guru, so I'm not 100% on that, but I'm quite sure that's the case.
Is anyone a licensing guru? Hello, I'm a licensing MVP.
There are people whose entire jobs is to deal with licensing. I don't envy them,
Or
but they
salsa they
exist.
are. Okay, so the deployment then, how, if you've got a, like, let's say you do your CI build. So in the CI build, you'd build a setup kit.
Yes. Yep. Typically, you might use some Visual Studio Setup project or
Wix thing or something.
a Wix project.
Store shield.
If you gave up on your previous life of dealing in licensing and want to move to Install Shield, yes.
Wise installer or Nullsoft. I'll stop now. So
Yeah.
you take that and then you reset the environment in Virtual Machine Manager. It resets the lab, puts all the images back. Too bad if anyone was connected to the lab at the time. And then how do you trigger the install?
Right, so after you've chosen your environment and your build you're working with in the lab build definition, the next step is the deployment step, and it allows you to specify for each of the machines that you have in your environment. So as I mentioned before, you might have had a web server and a database server. You can say for the web server, I want to run this script, and it gives you a couple of variables to refer to the build output path to find those scripts. And so you can just end up with a series of steps to say web server, run this script with these parameters, database server, run this other script with these different parameters. And it'll work through those steps to basically configure the result of that build into that environment as needed.
And those scripts are in the build as well.
Yeah, so I naturally everything should be in source control, so yeah, those scripts are also source controlled, and I typically make sure that when the CI build happens, that a copy of those scripts find their way to the output directory.
And these are MS build scripts?
No, so these are basically anything. If you had
I said
a Wix
the
project in your solution, then these scripts might be. You might just say, run MSI exec with this MSI file. That could be what it is. I tend to use a lot of PowerShell, so I'll have a PowerShell script there instead. But it's any process that can be invoked.
I suppose then the question that comes to mind is that's doing the deployment out of the build process itself. So you do the build and you're deploying out of the same build. So obviously, if the compile phase, you don't deploy, but if it passes, then everything goes into this lab environment.
Yes.
If I wanted to go to a different environment that's not a lab environment, such as a UAT or a pre-prod or something like that, then how do you do that?
Right. So first and foremost, I make sure that whatever the deployment scenario is for going to the lab environment or that first environment out of dev is the same all the way through to production. So you might have to provide some different parameters. Maybe your servers have different names. You got different service accounts, different URLs, but the script that does the work is the same regardless, and you just provide those slight configuration changes. Secondly, to then actually trigger that, obviously in the lab environment, TFS 2010 has all the infrastructure to manage that. When it comes to deploying to environments which you don't want lab manager or aren't necessarily going to be virtual or within the sort of scope of that system, there's an open source project that I've been working on for probably a couple of years now and has existed much longer than that, that I like to use. It's called TFS Deployer. This is very similar to the way the lab works, is you're able to define through a config file that you store in your source control a relationship between build definitions and the probably sort of underused build quality of a build in TFS. So you've probably run several builds in TFS if you've used it before and noticed that you can set them to have a quality. Typically, I think out of the box, it's options like rejected or to be investigated and items like that.
Yeah, I
That
kind of
list
prefer,
is.
the crap, the really crap and the uber crap.
Yeah, and that list is completely customizable, and some people just use it as a notation.
Well, it doesn't do anything out of the box in TFS, does it?
In
It's just an editor.
2008 and prior, it doesn't do anything. I haven't fully played with it, but I do believe that the testing features in 2010, the part of the test manager, they do hook into that. Again, it is mostly just metadata, but there is a little bit more emphasis placed on that. But yeah, so because this TFS deployer has existed since TFS 2005, that seemed like a really good hook point. And so the idea is you would customize that list to be things like deploy to UAT.
Mm-hmm.
And TFS deployer is an agent that you can install either on the target systems, or if you don't want to do that, and there are some dependencies that TFS deployer takes, which is a reason not to do it, you can deploy them on another system in the same environment. It will then subscribe to TFS for any events when people change that build quality. And if someone sees a build and they change it from the default build quality of blank to deploy to UAT, and in your source control, you've got a TFS deploy configuration file that says for this build, if it gets changed to deploy to UAT, run this script, then TFS deployer will notice that and it will go and grab that build. It'll go and grab that script and it will run it on the machine and cause that deployment to occur, and then send an email to a nominated person as to the result of that deployment, success or failure, if that's the case.
Very cool. Very cool. So what happens, I suppose the scripting part is probably the key to this, obviously, because TFS then is your trigger point, right?
Exactly. So yeah.
This is a thing to do, now go do. The script itself, how does it know what build you're doing?
Right. So at its simplest, TFS deployer supports two types of scripts. One of them is the standard command script or batch file. Batch file has been known for many years, but as far as I'm concerned, they renamed that a few years ago and wait for build to catch up. and in that case, it basically passes the UNC path of the build drop to the batch file as one of the arguments.
That's just the file share?
Yes. But it doesn't have to be a file share. The PowerShell is the alternative that it supports. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it's taking the object which represents the actual build itself that you get back from the TFS API, and it pushes that through to the PowerShell script. And because PowerShell is all about dealing with objects, with properties, etc., rather than parsing text like a typical shell, it's then got that rich data, one of which is the path to the drop location of the build. But it also has some extra data like when the build happened, details about the tests that were in it, and all sorts of other stuff. Basically, whatever the TFS API normally gives you, and you can do some extra stuff with that if you like. One of the things I used to do, but have now integrated into TFS deployer directly, was to set the retain build flag on the build when it was successfully deployed. Just
I
one
suppose
of the things
that's always a good thing, isn't it? Because TFS will do its purging automatically based on how many builds, and then if you've got a build out in an environment and you're going, let's just check version 1.3 and see what the code was like, and oh crap, where's the build gone? We can't redeploy this anywhere.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, half the reason for source controlling everything and having builds that appropriately version your files is so that when you have an issue in a particular environment, you can go and have a look there and go, this build that we've got here came from this set of source artifacts, and being able to follow that line back through. And if you forget to set the retain build flag and TFS goes and cleans up something that you've got deployed in production, suddenly it's a little harder to track that back.
Build it. You've just got to pass the right parameters into the build, but it's annoying.
Right, but I guess one of the first things is, how do you know what chain set it was and which branch?
Well, so depends how you do your versioning.
Yeah.
You can also, on the build in TFS, you can actually do the build, set the version number and label sources at the same time as part of that whole process. So you can always just go find the label.
Yeah. So if you're pushing the label, for example, into the version metadata of the files you deploy, or as an additional file into the directory you deploy, then you can trace back to source control to find exactly what files were used to build it. But if you then use the right arguments to rebuild that, how do you know that the state of your build server hasn't shifted such that it's going to generate different output?
And let's face it, going back and rebuilding from source to make sure that the code you've got in UAT can be deployed to production seems a bit dodgy anyway. Really, yeah. You just take your UAT server and turn it into your production box.
Yeah, just redirect the firewall.
Too easy. Done. So I suppose one of the other issues then with automatic deployment is there's these guys with suspenders and beards who don't like you touching any of their stuff.
Yep.
So how do you deal with the human side of dealing with sysops and DBAs that say, get off my lawn, young whippersnapper?
A lot of the time, the sysadmin guys, I find are actually happy to take an MSI and run that. So if you happen to...
Even though you can do all kinds of evil in an MSI.
Yeah, so exactly. And so once you sort of establish that they'll take that level of evil, then...
And they'll click the yes, run as admin prompt.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there is other stuff. I mean, firstly, PowerShell is a primarily targeted at the sysadmin world. It's supposed to be the new VB script. And I guess what...
don't say it like that.
Yeah, from that point of view of being the scripting platform of choice for sysadministrators, it's the new VB script. In terms of being an evil bit of a language to work with, it's quite the opposite. But yeah, so while I guess there's still a lot of time for the sysadmins around the world to catch up, it's going to be something that they're going to be familiar with, and so they're likely to be able to sort of overview it and understand it and get to a point of being able to trust it. Also, the alternatives tend to be to give them a bunch of files and say, look, you know, here's a two-page deployment manual.
Copy this file here, copy this file here.
Yeah.
Don't and what miss I anything.
What I find works really well is you give them the two-page manual and you let them do it once, and then the following iteration you say, look, I can give you this two pages again, or I can give you the script that will do it for you. And they're usually pretty quick to take the script option.
And you just walk them through the script so that you get comfortable with what's going on?
Naturally, yes.
Oh, very good. All right. I think we're probably getting close to time there. One thing, though, that I wouldn't mind just understanding is, are there any other tips and things just to help in terms of people who are moving into doing automation and deployment automation in particular the first time? You know, they might be in a team, small team, they're going, you know what, all this manual stuff's killing me, let's try and automate it. What are some good places to go to figure out how PowerShell works or how did you learn it, etc., that sort of thing?
In terms of learning PowerShell as a language, I found the best resource was a book called Windows PowerShell in Action. It was written by, I think it was Bruce Payett, who was on the PowerShell team.
Yep.
And he also has a bit of a Unix background as well, which sort of explains some of the roots of the language. And it's also something that he goes into quite good detail in the book about not only how it works, but why it works that way and why those decisions were made. And so I find that very useful to sort of come to terms with and sort of absorb why things are the way they are. And I know he has version 2 of his book to coincide with version 2 of PowerShell. It's being written at the moment, and I think you can buy it from the publisher as an early access book.
It's a Manning book, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So that's my primary resource for learning the language. I also found that just picking up various programming puzzles and trying to bang them out in PowerShell was a good way to get that to sink in. But I guess the other part of PowerShell is that beyond the language, it's really about being the glue between all the various server components and et cetera that you have to deal with, especially in a deployment. And so one of the major ones is IIS version 7 now has a PowerShell module available to it. So you can work with all the websites and app pools and virtual directories and configure all that sort of stuff through PowerShell.
So no WMI anymore?
No WMI anymore, unless you're still stuck with Windows Server 2003 and iOS 6, then you'll still be playing with WMI. But yeah, if you've moved on to something in the last, what, 3, 4 years,
So, I shouldn't tell you the client I'm at the moment's about to run into end of life on XP Service Pack 2.
yeah, that's iOS 5.1, isn't it? Yeah, so
It's beautiful.
that's even more fun. Yeah, if it's the iOS stuff, then the iOS.net website has some really great tutorials and examples on the PowerShell stuff there. And because I think Microsoft has now made PowerShell support part of their standard, I guess, done criteria for a lot of their server components now, you're starting to see each of those products come with PowerShell modules as well. And at the end of the day, you can still call out to all the old school sort of ways of doing things. So
Because
you can still
obviously
use.
they haven't taken that away.
No, not at all. A lot of that stuff still works. I mean, you can still use WMI for iOS 7 if you really want to. Yeah, and so a lot of it comes down to just working with it. And it's quite amazing how much stuff there is for doing stuff via PowerShell. I think there's a Skype via PowerShell and
Really?
Twitter via PowerShell.
Well, you
Yeah.
did that one, didn't you? You did what your no, you did get that little 3-line script that grabbed the tweet stream and whacked it
And
out.
pushed it through the
Yeah.
the Microsoft speech
Yeah,
synthesizer.
that was amusing.
Yeah, it was quite fun for a few lines of code. That's one of the great
Three
things about
lines of
PowerShell is.
PowerShell script and then some the screen's reading your tweets to you.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, Jason, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for coming on and having a chat to us about all things build and PowerShell and everything else.
Thank you. It was great to have a chat.
Very good. And thank you everyone for listening. We'll catch you next time on Talking Shop Down Under.